Wake up with the Big Breakfast, weekdays from 5:30.
Today on the show, we had a true legend of Australian sport. Forget about the fleas and muppets who are playing tennis or rugby league. This bloke, you have to hear his story to believe it. A world champion.
Also, I asked these guys for some much-needed advice for my 18-year-old son because I am desperately struggling to tell him what to do.
And I'll reveal the scariest place I've ever performed stand-up comedy. No, it's not Gympie.
They say money makes the world go round. Show me the money. Well, unless you're a flat earther, then you've got a whole lot of other issues going on.
Make money, money, make money, money, money.
Win $1 million with Triple M's Millionaire Listener.
Yeah, yeah, I'm living life in the fast lane.
The Big Breakfast with Marto, Robin and Nick Cody in the morning. And $1 million while you're at work. 104.5 Triple M.
It is the world's greatest rally for both motorcars and motorbikes. The Paris to Dakar, it used to be, is now just the Dakar over 2 weeks of the most gruesome, hellish conditions.
So tell me what they do.
They used to ride Paris to Dakar, and then there was a civil war, and they decide there's a country, whether it's, you know, Northern Africa, or this year it was in Peru, okay? And in 2016, a Gold Coast bloke called Toby Price, one of the hardest men you'll ever meet, he broke his neck in 2013, came back Jesus. April 2013. He rode in 2014, 15, got back on the bike. And 2016, he won the Dakar Rally. Incredible for an Australian, okay?
And it's over sand dunes and stuff, isn't it?
It's over sand dunes. It's not mud-sealed roads. They've got to do their own, all their own, how do you get there, navigation, everything. 2017, I reckon he broke his leg. He was still just getting over that in 2018, the Dakar, okay, and finished third in 18. I'm proud to say that last Friday morning, he won the Dakar race, the most awesome and highly decorated off-road rally race in the world. And again, he is, again, the Dakar champion. It's Toby Price. Hello, mate.
Hi, mate. How are we doing? Thanks for having us.
Oh, wow. What are you doing? Oh, sorry. Forgot to mention, broke his wrist in December of last year and rode the Dakar, the whole thing, with a broken wrist. First of all, what was that like? 2 weeks of hell with a broken wrist.
Yeah, exactly that, how you describe it. It was 2 weeks of hell. So, it wasn't too comfortable. But, we went in for a quick surgery in December and got the bones screwed back together. And, It just held in and then, we're able to try and make sure we push through and get the job done.
When you say quick surgery, I picture a pit stop in F1. Like, you just put your hand out the window, they go, he's off, get him on the bike.
Yeah, it was pretty much exactly like that. It was in the hospital like at 8 o'clock in the morning and out of there at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So it was wham, bam, thank you, and done. So it was out of control.
So wasn't it hurting? Like, how would you actually, like, ride a bike, let alone win an awesome race, when you got a broken wrist?
Yeah, that was it. It was definitely very uncomfortable the whole way. I getting on the plane here in Brisbane, I actually didn't quite know if I was actually going to make the whole race. So I was going to be happy to make stage three and then pretty much maybe call it quits and come back home. Have a holiday then. But yeah, it didn't turn out like that. We were situated in some good spots and good areas position-wise. And as the rally kept going along, I was in the perfect position to try and keep being near the front. And as it all panned out, we ended up winning the race. Yeah, that victory takes away all the pain.
Hey, Toby, tell us about a day-to-day basis. How many Ks were you doing each day? And mainly it's through desert, a lot of it's sand. And what were you doing at night time? How do you guys sleep? Because I know some people just were rolling up a swag and sleeping raw.
Yeah, pretty much. For us, our minimum day, we normally have around 500 kilometres, anywhere up to about 800, maybe 900 kilometres in a day. So, it's long days. And then luckily enough with me, I arrived for the factory KDM team. We do have like campers and stuff there that we get to...
Oh, you're fancy
night,
now, righto.
Oh, yeah, I'm fancy. It's like five-star luxury for us, nearly. But, yeah, we sleep there at night. We basically prep all our stuff for the next day of racing and then, jump on the bike and about around 3 to 4 o'clock in the morning we're waking up and going at it again.
Now, Toby, am I correct to ask you, you're sponsored by Red Bull?
Yes, very correct.
I'm here in studio with Marto. You've used Red Bull, right, to take a broken wrist across a desert. Marto uses Red Bull just to talk on the radio in the morning.
Mate, that's it. Red Bull gives you wings, so it definitely gave me some while I was over there, that's for sure.
Toby, can I just check? It's not all about speed. When you're in the middle of that sand dune, you've still got to go past markers. How the hell do you find them? I imagine the signal's not great in the middle of Peru.
No, look, they're definitely, we have a GPS system on the bike, but it's not like no TomTom that's in a normal everyday car telling you where to go. So it just basically locates where you are, just for safety reasons in case I do have an accident or something. But they're hidden waypoints. So basically it's virtually like trying to find a needle in a haystack. You have to cross by a certain area by like a radius of 100 metres or to 50 metres.
I think that should be the new saying. I don't think needle in a haystack's big enough. I reckon invisible waypoint in a desert. It sounds a lot harder.
That's it. Toby Price from KTM Red Bull Dakar Rally Champ for 2019.
Not Atomic, not a Kyrgios, a proper athlete. And the best mullet I've ever seen, mate. He's just got hair. Have a look. Check him out if you can. He's the king.
That's high praise, Toby, because Marto knows mullets.
No, mate. At the moment, I've definitely got a good full-size mullet now. So I made a little bit of a silly bet with a fellow competitor. And you had to shave the front end off it, so it's definitely a mullet now for sure.
Big breakfast, Triple M.
You know, last week the uni offers came out for Year 12 students last year, and my heart sank a little bit because I was imagining, as I remembered this from my own son last year, that, you know, you rip open that envelope or you go online and you check whether you got into the course that you've been hoping you'll get into. And
that's
then,
how it works for a lot of people.
Right, that's how it works, okay. But now that I'm 12 months on and my son, who's 18, nearly 19, has finished his first year of uni, he's kind of like those kids again because he's really not sure that what he's doing is what he wants to do. And I think that there's a lot of boys particularly, there'd be some girls, but I think that just the way that young men mature, like he's come out of, and this is why I wanted your advice, because I'm seriously really struggling to give him some words of meaning that can help him. Mm. So he's come out of 6 years of high school and very institutionalized, where you're told what to do, where to do, how to do it. Yeah. He had spoon-fed, absolutely, had schoolies, had a wonderful break, and then started to do uni. Now, he got into aviation because he thought that would be a cool job to have. And I think in his mind, he imagined himself in a pilot's uniform and chicks falling all over him, basically.
I went to university for 6 months to do a Bachelor of Business Sports Management because when I was 17, I watched Jerry Maguire's run.
Okay.
Wow.
And I was like, show me the money. And then I turned up. I'm like, this sucks. There's heaps of paperwork.
stuff to do.
And I'm envisaging that was kind of where my eldest son was at. He's seen Top Gun and gone through, not actually taking in mind that being a pilot requires a huge amount of maths, and maths was never his strong point.
Oh, dear.
So now we've finished the first year, and he's just really despondent. He doesn't really want to go back, but he knows that all his mates are going back to second year uni. He's got, you know, his life is kind of established around the fact that his friends do uni. And as I started to ask more mums and dads that I know this question, there's a lot of kids doing the same.
Has he got a part-time job?
Yes, he does. He works as a landscaper,
a labourer. Stay with that. That's what will give you identity rather than studying anything.
Do you reckon, though?
Make it a full-time job.
So he likes digging up the ground more than flying in the sky?
No, he doesn't. He doesn't. No. He's doing it for the money. I mean, and he's good at it and they like him. I thought...
Do you have to go to uni to become a pilot, though? Can't you just go to Archerfield and still leave the keys in one of them? No, but can't you just take lessons? Do you have to do all the maths?
But you still need to know how to navigate and stuff.
No, I reckon if you fly for Scoot, most of those airplanes get turned around due to a mid-air brawl, so you won't even have to know how to fly the whole distance.
I told you they'd be no good at advice, really, didn't I?
Big breakfast on Triple M.
Getting to know Nick Cody. Getting to know all about Nick Cody.
Now, I have mentioned some of my jobs over the last week. I used to be a nanny. I've worked in a brewery. I've worked in an office, many office jobs. But for the last 12 years, I've been a stand-up comedian. And easily the coolest gigs I've got to do were for our troops over in the Middle East and Afghanistan.
When, where particularly?
So 2013, I went, you do the first shows in Dubai. There's a base just outside of Dubai. You do shows at. Then I went to Afghanistan, to Tarin Kaut, Kabul, and Kandahar. All the places I've always wanted to go, but Kentucky don't do tours there. So,
can I check, you know how comedians always whinge about, oh, you never want to do a breakfast gig because everyone's sober. What about the soldiers? They'd be fairly serious and everything stern and everything. Do they still muster a laugh?
No, it's quite the opposite. When your entertainment guide for the year has two things on it, they're actually pretty pumped that you've turned up.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And you get to, it's one of the best jobs at stand-up comedy. You can just make fun of their bosses because it's illegal for a soldier to make fun of the officers.
Oh.
But we can hang as much on them. So as soon as you step off the plane, it's just young guys and girls running over going, this guy's a dickhead.
You get the list.
This chick's a mole. Make fun of her for this. Make fun of. They'll just give you a list, and you just get to tee off. So you're like a conduit for them to say stuff that would get them kicked out of the forces.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It's quite nice.
So how do you go with the set routine, or do you take your Australian stuff and then mould it based on what the information they're giving you?
Yeah, it's a bit about. So the stand up over there, you do stuff from home because they all want to hear stuff about home because some of the guys and girls have been over there for 8 or 9 months. And then you're doing stuff that you've talk about things that you've noticed on the trip there.
Sand.
And I remember.
Do any sand gags?
Sand gear.
Yeah.
Woo! What about this sand?
It's everywhere. It's pretty hot, isn't it, guys? I'm in an air-conditioned room. I'm not fighting, but for 3 minutes I was outdoors, it was brutal. I remember, though, this is the best bit about Australia. I was with Bliss and Esso, Aussie hip-hop group.
Yeah. I love them.
And Bliss, he is from the US originally, and at one point at the show in Tarancourt, there's 900 soldiers, Aussie, American, Kiwis, Brits. And he said, everybody, put your guns in the air. Everyone's just strapped. They've got their rifle and their sidearm with them.
What, while they're performing, while you're all on stage?
No, they're not performing. They're just watching.
But while you're on stage, they've all got firearms.
Live ammunition.
A lot of pressure, yes.
A lot
live ammo in there, ready to roll, right? All the Americans put their guns in the air, and Bliss said, I've got to stop the concert. Hey, how come none of you Aussies put your guns in the air? And one of the blokes said, too many forms to fill out, mate. You can't even bring your gun out in a war zone. It's a bloody nanny state.
It's a big breakfast on Triple M.
Hey, Serena Williams, anyone see you last night?
Oh, yeah, in a big green jumpsuit.
Oh, out like the Riddler.
It did look like the Riddler.
Is her backside getting bigger? She's an incredible athlete. We all know that. But that thing's got its own postcode these
days. That's her engine room. That's where she can, she is so powerful.
Actually, anyone involved with high-powered vehicles will tell you the diff. That's where all the power comes from. And she is blowing. She is on another level. That girl was number one in the world. Yeah. Have a listen to some of the noises she makes, though. It's incredible. Her serving, volleying. All right, that's what you're up against, this enormous human being making those noises. And I find something out this morning. Did you see her mum at the end of the match didn't get up and everyone's going, oh, come on, you're so used to winning, you don't even care about your daughter. I then do a bit of digging. Do you know they're Jehovah's Witnesses?
I did not know that.
So you can't celebrate victory.
No, you're supposed to be humble at all times and you can't do a lot of stuff. No sex before marriage, no Easter, no Christmas, no any of that stuff.
So she's not allowed to celebrate her daughter's success?
No birthdays for a daughter.
Oh, no.
What's her name? Serena's daughter doesn't celebrate birthdays. She will never celebrate a birthday. They don't do any of that stuff.
Why?
You imagine your mum's worth $100 million and you can't get a birthday present. Suck to you.
Exactly. Can you imagine Serena coming to your house after she's finished playing? Can I speak to you about the Lord?
Yes, I will hear about the Lord.
Absolutely.
It's a big breakfast on Triple M.
I was watching the news yesterday and I love politicians always talking their way around things in the past. And I think Bill Shorten has absolutely nailed this. Opposition leader Bill Shorten conceded that he may have taken illegal drugs during his university years. Now, this is what he said. I've answered this question about drugs before. I can't rule out in my university years I might have taken or done something.
Whoa. Oh,
come on, mate. That just means you did.
That is so much worse than just saying, I don't know. I may have taken or done something.
Here's my question, though. Can you ever get charged for admitting to doing something illegal from your past?
Who did you kill, Robin? Who did you kill? If you've done a murder, just fess up. I know the cops are looking in bins today for stuff.
Yeah, no, they do not.
The statute of limitations?
Correct.
We have
yeah.
that? No, yeah, but 7 years or is that tax returns?
I think it's 7 years.
Have you not paid your tax? I'm learning more and more about my co-hosts as they incriminate themselves.
One murderer and a tax dodger.
Now, you guys yesterday had a laugh when I just flippantly said that my grandpa used to make me roll cigarettes for him. So I had more of a think overnight. I remembered as a kid, my grandpa would buy Chop Chop, illegal tobacco.
The illegal stuff, yeah.
Yeah, we'd go to a milk bar. They'd lift up the big thing of Bubble O Bills and Magnums, and I'd go, what is under there? Right? I thought that's where magic lived, and it did, in the form of illegal tobacco.
Really?
He'd buy a few kilos of it, bring it back to my grandparents' place. He'd put it in a big pile on the kitchen table. And then he had these filters that you'd use. It was like a little stapler. You roll the filter onto the end. You fill it up with tobacco. And then you go, like an old,
how old were you?
Credit card reading
machine. How old
machine.
Were you?
I'm 158.
No.
Seriously,
then,
how old were you when you were
eight? Six or seven?
Cigarettes were worth less than a dollar a packet. Imagine how keen he'd be now to get a bit of chop into it.
He loves a dart. And he'd make my cousins and I race. And the first one that made him 30 ciggies got an ice cream. And
because he picked up a Buffalo Bill on the way out.
My God, that's unbelievable.
But I just remember, I was like, at the time it was so much fun because you're racing to bloody win an ice cream.
Oh.
But looking back on it, it does seem a bit Nike sweatshop-esque.
It's funny though, like, yeah, because my grandmother used to make us, she lived up in the Blue Mountains in Sydney, or in New South Wales, and we'd go up for school holidays, and as a special treat, we'd be able to have roast chicken on a Sunday.
Yeah.
But the problem was you actually had to catch the chook and chop its head off.
Of course.
So
what a treat.
My sister and I would always run screaming when she was going to get the axe.
How funny are the chickens when they do run around with their head cut off?
Well, here's the thing. So she'd cut the head off, and then she'd tell us that, you know, the
chase
chook was,
her out.
Yeah, and then she'd catch it, and our job was to pluck the chickens.
Oh, that's a terrible job.
So
boil them and pluck them.
Gee, that's bleak, Robin.
And I just want to know, what jobs did you get as a kid? Weird jobs from your grandparents?
I remember going up to Stanthorpe to my grandfather's orchard, okay, and I didn't realise he may have been an alcoholic because I rang Dad one morning, it was 6:30 in the morning before we went to work, and I said, oh, Pa's having a long neck, a tallie, I think we used to call him at home. I was 12 or 13, not realising that was a bad thing. My first job before I had to pick peaches was to go and tidy up Pa's shed and put all the tallies from the day before away.
What, recycle them or did you get any money for them?
No, he was stacking them like they were a trophy cabinet. I don't know what he ever did with them or where they ever went. But
that's how you know you've got a drinking problem. If you don't have a recycling bin but a recycling shed.
Kylie of Bellbird Park, what did your grandparents make you do?
Oh, my grandparents were evil. They used to send my brother and I down to the pig stall in the back of the property to clean it, like, every second morning.
That'll toughen them up.
I know. And then one morning we opened up the shipping container and there was all these dead little piglets hanging.
What do you mean hanging?
They had been, obviously, you know, gutted and bled.
Ready to go.
It was absolutely horrendous. But my brother, because he was younger, he still had no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that was on the dinner table that night.
He was just rapt that they hadn't made much of a mess, those ones.
I know, and he had named them too.
Oh, that's awful.
Never named them.
Yeah, you never name a farm animal. Peggy.
Kylie, I wonder if she eats pork. Hello, Tone of Ipswich.
My old man used to take me up to the grandparents' place when the lavatory tin was overflowing and my job was to dig a hole and bury it for him.
No. What? No, yeah. That's an adult job.
Character building, he said it was.
Yeah.
About 7, 8, 9, something like that.
That's too young.
Can't dig properly at that age.
It's not character building, it's bacteria building. That is filthy.
Yeah, well, I don't get a cold much, eh?
Oh, righto, Tone.
You've gone through it all. Thanks, Tone. Mark of Redbank Plains, what did your grandparents make you do? Hey, Mark.
Are you there?
Yeah.
Sorry to bother you, mate. I think you rang us. Mark.
You there?
Yeah, you in that toilet.
Hello.
Oh, dear.
Mark.
Hello.
Mark. That's annoying.
How's he indicating while on the toilet? That was the largest echo in a car I've ever... Obviously, Lime Scooters taking over the fine city, but City Cycle seem to be on the way out. Nobody's riding them. I think I've figured out why, right? I've been in Brizzy now for a little bit.
Nick, can I just give you a historical overview? They've been going for 12 or 13 years. Yeah. Okay, and they were duds for the first 7 years, and they're so heavy and awkward, no one wants to get them. These lime tutors are the shiny new thing.
Yeah, the city cycles aren't going to work because it's hot and there's hills.
Yeah, really. Yes. Have you seen Miskin Street in Toowong? Like, really?
Who wants to pedal a half-ton bike up a hill in the heat when you could just zip around on your bloody lime scooter?
On a motorised scooter.
Mind you, I did see two backpackers who'd clearly come out of the big backpackers on the corner of Edward and, is it Adelaide? No. Anyway, you know that really big backpacker
place?
Oh,
yeah, the old Temperance League place.
Yeah, yeah. And you go up the hill, up Edward, and they were desperately trying to get these scooters. And you could see them. They were trying to rev them. Yeah. And as they're going, it was ridiculous.
You got to push them up hills a little bit.
No, they weren't doing that. They were getting on and going backwards and then getting off and trying to run up. It's like, dudes, it's not going to work.
They don't quite have the power of a four-wheel drive. That's fair enough.
No,
that's good to know.
Get you out of trouble.
There's no turbo version of a lime
scooter. I've got to ride one this week. I'm 100 kegs, right? I'm 100 kilos, yeah. Triple digits. I want to see how fast a lime scooter can take me.
Oh, they reckon up to 30 k's.
That's downhill with a heavy man. With a heavy... Mate, I'm 100 as well.
What are you saying,
No, I'm 100 without... I've done my research because I'm 100 as well, and they do go real fast downhill but not fast uphill. I'll confirm that.
But if you're a bigger guy, surely you get faster if you're going downhill.
Yeah, you do. That's what I mean. They go faster.
Don't even rev it.
But they go slower
just
uphill.
So you want to grab it. So you're both the
extra
same
beer
weight.
Are you both the same weight?
I feel
but Marto's about 6'9". I'm 5'3". You know what I mean? I'm a little... Looks better on him.
The big breakfast.
It's almost if one of us was an athlete.
Four kilos of yours is beard.
Big breakfast on Triple M.
Ever since winter ended and the snakes started coming out for breeding and getting out and about, there's been big reports on going the worst snake season of all time for biting ones and also constricting ones. And I tell you what, last week there was a case in Wishart where a carpet python nailed the family's two pet cats. And then just
one wasn't enough?
And then just the other day up at Noosa, their family cat, this family's cat, got nailed by another python. And I want to talk about it, just saying there seems to be a real epidemic of pets going. I've got Luke Huntley here, who's... What is the name of your snake-catching company, Luke?
Snake Catcher Noosa, up in Noosa, Sunshine Coast.
All right, tell us about the one you got the other day at Noosa. What happened?
So basically, I got a call from this couple in Noosa, and they heard a bit of a noise earlier that morning. Anyway, they went outside, and their pet cat had been following this possum and its baby around for a while. So it's obviously been trying to get to the baby possum. And obviously the snake had come along, and it was trying to get to the possum as well. And anyway, so obviously their paws crossed at some point. Can't be exactly sure when. And, the cat lost. And, the snake ended up inside the cat.
Had the cat eaten the possum already and then the snake ate it like a turducken? Like, was there three different pieces?
Thankfully for the native, the possums didn't know. They're fine. They got away.
Good.
Okay, it doesn't kind of compute in my head because I think that a cat has claws and a teeth and snake don't. So how do they lose in that particular battle?
Well, in Australia, 650 million... reptiles a year, including skinks and so on. Jeez. So that's, hundreds of millions of snakes are killed by cats every year. Man. So in most cases, the cats always win. But in very rare circumstances like this, it's almost like, one in 50 million where the cat actually loses. So,
I've seen... pythons take birds before. The cat would have been asleep, I imagine, and my dog's been had a go at by a python as well.
Oh,
but
really?
They wait until the animal's asleep, and then they just get there. They slowly wrap around them, and that's when my dog yelled out. Ted yelled out because it was starting to get wrapped.
Oh,
so isn't that what happens, Luke?
Definitely an ambush predator. No, they won't just come charging across the lawn out of a tree towards an animal. They'll always wait in ambush and for the ideal moment where they can minimise the risk to themselves and they can maximise their constriction.
Cowards.
Okay, so if your cat, I'm going to get a bit technical here, but if your cat got swallowed or your guinea pig or whatever or your chicken got swallowed by a snake, at what point in the process does it die? Like if you were to be able to cut the snake's head off,
how long could it survive?
Yeah, could you pull your cat out and it would live?
No, look, the snake is only going to swallow its meal once it's constricted it and it's dead. So if your animal's gone in there, yeah, no, that's basically it. And also as well, killing a native animal is an $18,000 fine as well.
Okay, not that I was going to. Not just asking
but
the question.
But no one had ever fined out. That's why it's snake catcher noosa and not snake killer noosa. Yeah.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, why wouldn't you? But I'm thinking like the pet owner. That's their beautiful pet cat. I'm sure it belonged to one of the children. The snake's eaten it. Are you telling me the first thing done through your mind is revenge? Like, I'm talking to these guys more than anything. Like, wouldn't you kill that snake?
Well, you'd want maybe one.
18 grand, though.
Well, you don't tell anyone about it.
No. Yeah, just bury it. Put it in the bin.
And last question, technical question on snakeage. How long does it take to digest those big animals like possums and cats?
If it was like a possum or a cat or something like that, it'd take them a good few weeks. They'd curl up somewhere kind of warm but not too sunny, you know, kind of coolish as well, and I just sit there and digest it until we're ready to move on and do what they're going to do.
How long have you been doing this, Luke?
About 4 years now.
Right. How'd you get into it? You, as a kid, you liked picking up animals.
Yeah. See, for me, like, my one passion for my whole life has just been Australian wildlife, and I've always really loved reptiles and snakes, so, yeah, I thought I'd just devote my life to helping them and also helping people that are scared or they need them removed. So that's basically what I do, why I do what I do.
Oh, wonderful stuff. If you do have a pet, be vigilant. Luke Huntley, snake catcher noosa, thanks for your time. It's the Big Breakfast on Triple M.
I know we quickly spoke yesterday about Prince Philip, the Duke, a 97-year-old who had the car accident. 2 days later gets a new Land Rover, not wearing a seatbelt. Last night, the news kept chasing it up, suggesting that the Queen doesn't want to know much about him anymore.
Her Majesty buckled up as she arrived for church, stepping out for the service from the passenger seat. The past 72 hours have tested her patience.
On her own.
What, with Philip?
No, Phil. Nah. Oh, no. Left him at home. He is in shame. And the man I like to call the Duke of Hazzard. How his little song. Can you imagine the Queen in a pair of Daisy Duke denim shorts?
Never.
Come on, everyone, close their eyes.
Never.
Now, Nick, the car accident. I saw footage. I hadn't seen the full footage. It's a Kia has rolled a Land Rover.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable. Maybe it's like a wombat. You know how wombats can flip a car?
Yeah, because they're solid.
Here is in a little tiny Kia, you got the best chance.
Oh, and Prince Philip, the Duke of Hazzard, as I like to call him, not wearing seatbelt. Remember what happened? The last member of the British the royal family, 22 years ago, who didn't have a seatbelt on.
Yeah,
that's all I want to say.
You can't say that.
Mate, it's 22 years ago that she died.
It's a tragic time. We're all still reeling.
It's still too soon.
It's not too soon.
It's too soon.
I'm drinking out of my commemorative Diane cup.
It's the end of the podcast. What do you know? So tune in tomorrow and catch the show.
Triple M.